We're going to talk today, it's not so much about SE Linux. If anybody came and saw me yesterday, you already got bored to death with SE Linux stuff. So today we're going to cover a thing called Secure Linux Containers. Containers is a really, really hot topic right now. The problem is that everybody has a different definition of what containers are. So what you're going to hear today is my definition of containers, and I think it's pretty close to what people would expect from a container, especially if they sort of understand what Solaris containers are. First thing you have to understand is the kernel has no idea what a container is. The kernel has no concept of a container. It's just a user space construct. So what we're going to do is we're going to build up the parts of the operating system, the parts that the kernel provides in order for user space to build a container. And this is an actual Unixware containers in China, so they like to... Okay, so I like to argue that there are four pieces of building a container. There is process isolation. So when you build a container, you want to make sure that your processes are isolated from other processes and other containers. You want to make sure your resources are managed or controlled, right? You don't want one container to be able to take up 100% of the CPU. You want security. You don't want one container to be able to attack another container. And lastly, you need a management tool to manage all that, to set up the resource management, to set up the actual start the containers, to be able to set up the security to make sure they're separated. So you really need all four components. Google just released what they call a container, and really all they're covering in their container is resource management. They say in the future they might get into process isolation with it, but at this time they're only doing that. We're going to talk about Docker at the end, towards the end of the container of the talk. So that's the two hot ones right now are Docker and Google. Just as I said, Google just released their stuff. But basically all this stuff is built on top of the Linux kernel. So these are all components that we've added to the Linux kernel, and I'm going to go in and define all the points in the star here. So the first one is namespaces. Anybody ever hear of namespaces other than the people that attended my talk yesterday? Okay, namespaces is a mechanism for a process to change its worldview from its parent. As I like to joke, it's just like human beings, right? Every child looks at the worldview differently than its parent. So what a process can do is a process has the ability to say, from now on, I want to look at my own mount table. From now on, I want my own network. From now on, I want to have a different host name than my parent. So these are the six namespaces that are currently defined by the Linux kernel. So mount namespace has actually been around for a very long time. Mount namespace was actually introduced, it was introduced before RHEL 5. So RHEL 5 has a thing called PAM namespace. Anybody ever use PAM namespace? No. A couple maybe. PAM namespace is a mechanism you can actually set up so every single user on your machine has their own /temp. So a user logs into the machine, he looks at /temp, and every other user would look at a different /temp. It was actually introduced for MLS and SE Linux controls in order to get real high security, but basically it can be used without SE Linux, and I believe it can be even used on non-Fedora, non-RHEL operating systems. It's also been used in RHEL 6. Anybody that's ever played with the sandbox tool, SE Linux sandbox tool, it takes advantage of it. There's another slide, so I shouldn't jump in too far into this. UTS is host name and domain name. It's really not that significant, except that if you have lots of these containers, when you're inside of the container, it's really nice to execute host name and say, I'm in container one, as opposed to I'm on the host name. So that really is all it does. And I guess it does domain name too, so you could have a different NIS environment. Domain name's kind of a not often used thing. IPC is really kind of nice because you want to make sure that your shared memory segments, your semaphores, are only available inside of your container. You're not going to be shared with other containers. The really big one that everybody really likes is networking. So I can have my entire network stack different than my parent. I can have a different local host, and I can have a different IP address. I can even have full IP tables rules. So I can actually set up my container so that the process inside of my container can only be accessed by but one particular machine in the network inside of my network, while the entire host machine can actually get outside the network. So you can set up really advanced networking controls. PID namespace means that numbers of you can have more than one PID one. That's sort of the big one. So PIDs start counting again right at the top. So the first process that gets launched inside of a container is PID one. The containers that I'm going to show later are going to be running systemd as PID one, so it sort of makes sense, but you'll have multiple PID ones. The interesting thing is if you're on a Linux kernel, I mean a Linux operating system, you're on the host, you'll see systemd running multiple times inside of these containers. And the systemd's from the host point of view is going to be a different PID than it is inside of the container. So it's the same process, but basically the kernel's lying to the processes inside of the kernel. I mean inside of the container. Lastly, the one that was introduced the latest, came out this summer, is a thing called user namespace. And this one really is sort of the point where containers get a little closer to what you get with full virtualization. Because what it allows you to do is to have multiple UID zeros and have them isolated from each other, not using something like SE Linux. It just basically, the kernel starts to understand that you have capabilities of a privileged process, but only inside the container. All right. I know some kernel engineers throw up and don't believe that this actually ever works. Okay, but that's the goal of this thing, is that the process inside of the container will be UID zero, but outside of the container, it'll have no privilege. That came out in, as I said, this summer. I don't believe it's been turned on in Fedora yet, but it's probably going to be turned on fairly soon. I shouldn't say that. It's turned on in the kernel. It's turned on the kernel both in Fedora and in RHEL, but we've turned off user space's ability to turn it on, if that makes sense. So there's a call called clone that you could basically specify what you can turn on in the kernel, and the clone command right now doesn't have the ability to tell the kernel. So the kernel is blocking you from being able to turn it on, but all the code's in there. The reason we turned it on in RHEL 7, or will be turned on in RHEL 7, is we want to be ABI compatible with it when we find out, when we decide eventually that it is good enough or it's secure enough, we want to be able to turn it on and not have ABI breakage from RHEL's point of view. So those are the six namespaces, and some of these namespaces are already starting to be used. As I mentioned earlier, the mount namespace is being used in PAM namespace. In RHEL 6, it was used in the SE Linux sandbox. If you haven't played with the SE Linux sandbox, you get a real feel of what a container is capability of, and that's available right now on all Fedoras and RHEL 6 boxes. Systemd has actually added some really nice features that'll be in RHEL 7 and in current Fedora, probably in other platforms that use systemd, that they've turned on private temp and private network. A couple of releases ago, Fedora, I actually opened up a change request, and we changed probably about 20 or 30 system services to use private temp. This means that a very common CVE vulnerability in systems is people using root processes using the temp directory badly. First of all, for years I've been saying root processes should stay the hell out of temp, period. Right? Temp is for users. /run is for root process, but people continue to use it. Things like PHP scripts are constantly being written badly. Every week there's a new vulnerability of someone. The basic idea is if you go and create a well-known named file in /temp, a user that is also able to write to /temp could put a redirection in there and cause you to overwrite content, so they could basically subvert you. So with private temp and systemd now, you actually have the ability to have Apache have its own /temp that no users on the system and no other processes on the system would be able to use. So only Apache has access to its /temp. Private network is the same thing. You can do a really neat thing, and you can basically say that this system service is going to have no network. So when it comes on, all it has is localhost, or it doesn't have any access to, it can't connect outside the machine, period. OpenShift actually takes advantage. If you don't know what OpenShift is, that's Red Hat's PaaS server. It's available on the internet. If you don't know what it is, you should learn what it is. Kind of cool stuff. Go to OpenShift.com. But it takes advantage of, its container mechanism is SE Linux plus this private /temp, so each one of the OpenShift gears has their own /temp. So that's namespaces. So that basically takes care of making sure processes sort of see their own worldview. And again, it's process isolation, but it's not process security. So you have to understand, we'll get to the next section after C groups, we're not necessarily trying to prevent a bad process from doing something bad in the system. We hope that the namespaces do that, but namespaces don't cover everything on the kernel. But I'm going to talk about that when we get to the next the section after this. So after you get process isolation, now you want to make sure that the processes aren't able to do stuff like use up all the CPU on the machine, or use up, you know, hit the disk so fast or hit the network port so fast that the machine begins to degrade performance. So the way you do that is with C groups, which has been around. C groups is, everybody knows what C groups is? Somewhat? Okay. If you use RHEL 6, C groups is in RHEL 6. But C groups is about controlling CPU, memory, network, and block I/O. You can say stuff like, this container is only going to be able to run on the first CPU on this box, even though the box has six CPUs. You can pin it to a certain CPU. You can say stuff like, it can only use 50% of the memory in the machine, or it can only use 75% of the CPU. And you can do all sorts of balancing around these and control network throughput, all sorts of controls on it. So when you can create these containers, you want to use namespacing, you want to use C groups. C groups is being used, it's been in RHEL 6, used by libvirqmu right now for controlling virtual machines. OpenShift's using it to make sure all the gears have proper control. Systemd in RHEL 7 and all Fedoras is using C groups for controlling what system services can do. Red Hat Storage uses C groups to control that. Obviously, Google is using C groups. So Google's container technology is basically management of C groups.
Systemd really has some nice stuff for nice admin setting of C groups and per service that
right.
is missing from the C group controls in previous Fedora and RHEL 6.
Right.
If you don't learn that stuff that's in RHEL 6, if you can help it, it's
right. Right. So C groups first came out in RHEL 6, and it's kind of the wild, wild west. So there's no real control over doing it. Everybody can do anything they want in C groups. In RHEL 7, in the latest kernel, they're moving towards a one dictatorial role of who controls C groups. So it'll be more of a mother may I. So rather than having any process can go and move PIDs in and out of C groups and stuff like that, they're going to have to ask the init system to say, hey, I want to be in this, have this much CPU and this stuff, and init system will start to divvy the stuff up. So it understands how processes work and stuff. So it's been decided that in the kernel, that in RHEL 7, that's going to be controlled by caveat, not by the kernel. In RHEL 8 or and later Fedoras, the kernel is going to start to say that the first person that gets the control of the C group controller controls C groups. But right now, that's by convention.
Are C groups a way of doing resource control for groups and processes?
Yes.
You just mentioned something else. Is that what it's like? I heard you say it is, and I wasn't sure.
No, it's probably just my bad accent. So, perfect. English speaking, and everybody else talks funny. Right. So what C groups does is you create something that says that this C group is allocated 50% of CPU, or this C group is pinned to PIDs to the first CPU, and now you start taking processes and sticking them into the C group. So you take the actual PIDs, you write a PID file into the C group, and now you write the PID number into the C group, and the kernel sees that and starts to control the process at that level. Right. And the nice thing is systemd understands all processes, so when you say take Apache and stick it, Apache might have 400 processes, but each one of those, Apache understands all the processes underneath Apache and can stick them in it. Right. Right.
Should we just keep the questions to the end?
Yeah. He's trying to help me out. C groups is kind of a really nice feature. You can actually do something really kind of cool with C groups too, is you can freeze it. So you have the ability to say for a particular service, stop that service. and I mean, not kill it, but freeze it. So the, all the processes will stop getting any CPU time, and it'll freeze up. So you can do really nice things with C groups. So the reason I'm talking about this, obviously, SE Linux has a role in this. SE Linux is not required to do anything, so don't go running, well, I can't use containers because I can't stand SE Linux and I can't use it. But if you care about security, all of a sudden with containers, people, usually when people come up to me to talk about containers, they say it's about security. And I say, well, in security, you need SE Linux. And then they say, no, no, it's not about security. And then later on, they'll say, it's about security. The problem with process isolation is that process isolation is not foolproof, okay? We don't containerize. Linux containers is not like full Solaris containers in that everything has not been containerized. So there's major parts of /sys. Being able to mount file systems, being able to create device nodes is all free game for a person to be able to break out of a container. So if you have a privileged process inside of a container, it's able to create a device node, write certain things to the device node, is able to break out of the container and attack the other containers on the box. So when you're talking about containers, you really want to have a higher level security level wrapper around it that says, hey, you are container 5, you're not allowed to touch content that is labeled for container 4. So that's why SE Linux gets in. SE Linux has been around since RHEL 4. Most people wouldn't dare run it in RHEL 4. I certainly wouldn't. It's been in RHEL 5. We got to MLS, RHEL 6. We got this concept of MCS. So the container technology with SE Linux will be taking advantage of the same technology that's used to secure SVert, OpenShift, SandboxX. Now, this whole idea of the MCS separation. It came to my talk yesterday. You learn it. If you go to opensource.com on Monday, you'll get to see the cartoons coming out that explain it. So it's as simple as just cartoons. GRSec's never been accepted into the upstream kernel, so. So I'm not sure GRSec would actually provide you necessarily what you want here. I mean, they might have concepts to do this, but GRSec is about separating individual parts of the kernel from itself, so isolating parts of the kernel. So the last part of containers is how to manage it. Now, a lot of people that have used containers in the past or have started using containers use this thing called LXE, which was developed by IBM a few years ago. And LXE actually has the ability to set up all these namespaces. Okay, so LXE is a tool set for setting up the namespaces. The problem is it's command line and very hard to use. Secondarily, it hasn't built a lot of the higher level concepts that people are going to want to do with these containers. So Red Hat has decided that we don't want to ship LXE inside of RHEL. LXE actually does ship inside of Fedora. But so we decided that we wanted to use libvirt as the management tool because the model of using containers is very similar to the model of using virtual machines. The nice thing about using libvirt is it understands how to set up C groups, it understands how to set up SE Linux, it understands how to set up networking. And the networking one is the really key feature here because you really want to start to set up really complex networks with these things where you might want to set up virtual private networks between the containers and that type of thing. So really, having libvirt as your management tool for managing containers, we feel is a really powerful concept. So libvirt manages all those parts of the C groups, manages the device drivers, sets up everything for running a container and then launches the containers. Libvirt's been around for many years, and libvirt is actually also a key component in OpenStack. So using this version of containers, this way of doing containers, instantaneously gets you into a version that containers can start to be used inside of OpenStack. So these are use cases that Red Hat has looked at for, as I've talked to customers and other people have talked to customers, they've talked about using containers for these sort of workloads. Obviously, OpenShift, which is hundreds of thousands of user accounts running in the internet all on the same machine, is a classic case where you want to make sure each one of those user accounts is isolated from every other user account on the machine and really screams out for container type of control. I've talked to many large banks, and they want to set up machines in a demilitarized zone that have multiple instances of things like Apache and JBoss running on them, and they don't want to have the overhead of virtual machines. Or the management headache of virtual machines. So you can imagine having hundreds of Apache servers running on a single box, each one running their own instance of MySQL or JBoss or PostgreSQL. Red Hat Storage is looking at containers as a means to run applications on the cluster nodes so that they want to make sure that the process that's running, say Hadoop or something like that running on a cluster node, is somewhat isolated from the host so that they can make sure that it goes through the same protocol as if the Hadoop server was on a different machine. So those are use cases we've looked at inside of Red Hat for our customers. Now let's get into a couple of definitions of ways of setting up these containers. So everything I've just said right now actually can apply to Google's use case, although they probably want to take advantage of a couple of the parts. Docker, we're going to get into it later. But basically, we want to look at how do you set up the environment that's going to run inside of the container. So where does the code that's actually going to run inside of the container going to come from? So a one use case is basically what we call the generic application container. So you want to run an application inside of one of these things. And we built a tooling to be able to launch systemd inside of a container. So say Apache server running inside of a container, sort of looks like a mini operating system running. But in this case, we want to share the host operating system. So we've actually set up, the demo I'm going to show if I have enough time, can show running tens or hundreds, and we've actually run up to, I think, 1,000 shared Apache servers running on a single host, all sharing the same slash user. So treat slash user, basically treat slash as its read only, and then bind mounts read writable slash vars or slash etsy, parts of slash etsy where you want the container to be able to manage it. But everything else on the host is totally shared. So that's one use case of containers. A different sort of competing use case or a different way is sort of the cheruted containerized application. So a containerized application in this case means that all of user space is in its own cheruted environment. And it's very similar to what people have tended to do with these type of things, right? You set up a cheroot and only the files I want to have access executable inside of the program are going to exist inside the cheroot. And then you launch your application inside of one of those. The tooling that we have in actually current Fedora and RHEL 7 now is a tool called Vert Sandbox that you can play with right now. And Vert Sandbox basically will communicate with libvirt. Libvirt has a subsection called libvirt LXC and will actually launch any command inside of a container. So you could actually say Vert Sandbox, a few other commands, and then bin shell, and all of a sudden bin shell is running inside of a container. But again, it's using the shared host. A more complicated one is using Vert Sandbox to launch a systemd container. So this actually has the ability to have systemd launch containers. So say you set up 1,000 Apache servers running on your box, you really want to manage that the same way you managed any other service. So you want to treat containers as if they're just another service on the box. So with the current tooling we have right now, you can actually go in and just say system control Apache 1 sandbox, launch it, and it'll run inside of the container. But in this case, we're running systemd outside of the container, and we're running systemd inside of the container. So we want systemd controlling what's going on inside of the container, and then from the outside, it's actually just treating it like a service. This one, we've gotten up to 1,000 Apache servers running on a fairly hefty box. We've also been able to get 8,000 bash shells running inside of a box. Similarly, you could do cheruted applications. Same tooling will work with cheruted applications. So you could set up a RHEL 7 box with a RHEL 6 operating system on it and actually launch applications inside of RHEL 6. We've had customers talk to us about they want to run a RHEL platform with unsupported cheruted operating systems in it, say Fedoras. Actually, it was Fedoras. They want to run, so you have a RHEL 7 kernel and a RHEL 7 sort of file systems underneath, a really, you know, tight, good well-supported file system running it. And then you take the latest Fedora true-rooted operating system and put it on there, and that way they can take advantage of the latest glibc advances or anything in the user space that improves performance. So you can imagine the people who want really, really fast performance would like this idea. So you could do things like that. The last one is the booted operating system inside of a container. Okay, so I've talked about applications running in a true-rooted environment, but if you want to take your entire operating system and put it inside of a container and then treat it like it's a KVM, a virtual machine, we say, from a Red Hat point of view right now, we don't want to support that because there's lots of stuff that will break when you try to do that. And we believe that KVM is a better way to do that than to use containers for that workload where you're going to boot an entire operating system inside of it. So that with that point, we have a couple slides here. How am I doing on time? Okay, so let me quickly, this talk, because I want to get to the Docker stuff real quick. So these containers have improvements over virtualization and the speed of startup, ease of maintenance. With containers without rooted operating systems, you're only managing one host. So, you know, you do one yum update and you get the latest code onto it. You don't have to do yum update 1,000 times. They're easy to create, and during the demo I can show you, I have a script that I can go off and create 100 containers probably within 20 seconds, each one with their own Apache operating system, so imagine doing that with virtualization. System-wide changes are visible inside of each container, so if you have a security update, again this is the shared slash user, if you have a security update that comes to a system, as soon as you update it, all the containers have the exact same code as the host. And the scalability, as I said, we've gotten up to 1,000 of these fully systemd containers running. We've got 8,000 bin shells running. So you can scale to much higher numbers than you could ever with virtualization. The problem is, the nice thing here is that you get the nice memory sharing, because from the operating system's point of view, these are all processes. So if everybody's using the same glibc, they're all sharing the same glibc C segments, stuff like that. KVM versus, on the other side, these are its advantages. The biggest one is you can boot up other operating systems, okay, mainly Windows. You can't run Windows inside of a container, so get that wacky thought out of your head. You just have the Linux kernel is not going to support a Windows operating system. With separate kernel, you get better security. There's nothing, forget it, you know, SE Linux is better than not having SE Linux, but SE Linux is not as good as SE Linux plus KVM. Different kernel, so the attack vector to break out of a container is basically to find a vulnerability in the kernel. In a KVM case, you have to find a vulnerability in your kernel and then break through the hypervisor and then find a vulnerability in the host kernel. In a container environment, you are talking directly to the host kernel, so if you find a vulnerability, you're able to break out. The other thing about separate kernel that's good is if you crash the kernel inside of a VM, the VM goes down. If you crash the kernel in this, all 8,000 of your friends go down with you because the kernel crashes, everybody goes down. Guest isolation. So on the previous slide, I said guest isolation is good. On this slide, I say guest isolation is bad. I mean, it's also good, right? So in the other one, shared was good, and this one is bad. Yeah, so if I write something bad to one machine, it doesn't get picked up by everybody. So sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. So you get full separation. You get features like live migration, live storage migration. That doesn't exist in containers. There's no way right now, there's some really hacky ideas, but right now with the current Linux kernel, there's no way to take a container running on one machine and move it to another machine without having to shut down the container and move it over. So you can't maintain things like TCP IP connections between, you know, while you're moving them across. Scalability, as I said earlier, we've gotten scales to, I guess we've gotten to 6,000, some of these numbers are sort of shaky, but 6,000 to 12,000. 6,000 containers, 12,000 bind mounts, a root file system inside of the directories. Obviously, these things are basically doing almost nothing. So this is really, really, we were just looking for what's going to kill us, you know, when we try to scale up. We found things like pseudo-terminals, running out of pseudo-terminals. We found that actually running IPv6, you can only do about 87 of these things before it breaks. So we found different device drivers, and Ethernet device drivers could get to 1,000 and they started to break. So, but we've been, for certain workloads, we've been able to get up to 8,000 of these things running. So all this stuff, we went out and did all this work, and all of a sudden this thing, Docker, appeared on the scene. And Docker is like the hottest thing in the face of the planet right now, okay? So Docker came out. Docker came out of Docker.io, which is sort of a competitor of OpenShift, but Docker.io has now gone away. And Docker.io was a PaaS server, but they figured out a way to do some technology using containers for their isolation layer. Docker.io was not that, no one really was joining Docker.io, but they took Docker.io technology and built this thing called Docker. Docker took off. Now Docker.io Corporation is called Docker. Well, they've changed the name of the company anyways. And I think they've dumped Docker.io.com as the PaaS server is starting to disappear. Now what they've done is they've done some cool stuff. They're definitely in the cherooted, or basically an image-based operating system. So the operating system that they ship, or the containers they ship, have their own user space. They don't share anything with the host. So they're able to create these lightweight private PaaS environments. This is from their website, by the way. That's why I put the name down there, so don't get me for plagiarizing. But basically, they deploy large-scale web apps, databases, backends. What's really cool, I believe the coolest thing that Docker has done is actually have set up this registry of applications. So if you decide you want to run Hadoop on your box, you can say Docker run Hadoop run, and it will go out to this registry and will suck down an image that has Hadoop on it ready to run, and will run it on your platform. It's that easy. So they've done a really good idea. You know, so now people are going out and they're building these complex applications, just uploading them to a website, and you can just start running applications, you know, different types of applications in your box inside of these containers. So that's really kind of cool. And the operating systems they built are really, really thin, really, really small, you know, small as humanly possible. The problem we had, Red Hat had, is they were doing it all on Ubuntu. So we didn't like that. And we wanted to make sure they were on RHEL. And when we called them up and said, hey, we want to make sure it runs on RHEL, they said, that is the greatest idea on the planet, because people pay money for RHEL and they don't pay money for any other Linuxes. So their mechanism for making money is to get Docker to run on RHEL. So guess what happened? Right. So Red Hat and Docker got together and had a shindig. So Docker and Red Hat have started to collaborate and work together. And basically what we've tried to do is take some of their technologies that will never run on RHEL, yank them out, and put in better technologies for us. So the number one they were using is this thing called Union File System. The problem with Union File System is it's never going to get upstreamed into the kernel. Not only is that, but actually Ubuntu has started to dump it. Ubuntu doesn't want to support Union File System because there's too many headaches with it. So we had one of our engineers, a really awesome engineer, came in and said, we can do very similar things. So basically support the exact same workload using this thing that's device mapper, thin provisioning, which is something that's sort of built for LVM, but can be separated for LVM. But he's able to build the same type of containerized environments using this thin provisioning. So now you could run on a RHEL 6. You will be able to run on a RHEL 6.5 box, say an Ubuntu operating system running one of these applications using thin provisioning. Docker also uses LXC under the covers, and as I said earlier in the presentation, we want to use libvirt LXC. We don't want to support LXC. So the problem is Docker can run LXC, but they don't have any mechanism for setting up really complex container networking things unless you go into each one of the individual containers and set up the networking. You know, you can go inside of the container and set up all the networking, but you can't set it up from the outside. So with libvirt, so Red Hat is also engineering a additional back end to Docker to be able to run these other running without libvirt as well as libvirt, well, running with libvirt LXC as well as LXC. So Docker bundles the micro operating system with the application. It has a really simple CLI. I will say RCLI is a little too difficult to use, in my opinion. I would like to simplify it. It registries an registry of application containers available. I think that's the key. I think that's the best feature they've done with their tooling. They used to use UnionFS, and are now using Thin Device Mapper. So they've dumped UnionFS altogether as of their .7 release, and they've gone totally with the Device Mapper model. So even on even this will run on Ubuntu, and anybody else that supports Docker will be using Thin Provisioning. And currently, they're using the LXC toolset underneath the covers, but we're adding in libvirt LXC, and it's going to be an alternate backend. So you're going to have alternate backends. You're going to be able to use either backend. If you're going to run it on RHEL, you're going to have to use the libvirt LXC. And it's very hot. It's like, you know, everybody is hung up on this. And I think the main people that are really into it are developers. Because if you think about it from a developer point of view, the really cool thing about this from a developer point of view is he writes his code, distributes it on one operating system, and suddenly it can run on every operating system. Okay, so he doesn't have to write his code and make sure it runs on Ubuntu and Fedora and RHEL and old RHEL and new RHEL and future things. So he can do it once. Okay. Anybody in here that understands security should be saying, I don't know if I like that idea, okay? But from the developer's point of view, this is really cool. I'm not sure it's really cool from a sysadmin's point of view. So let's go through the two models come down to a bind-mounted writable partitions on a read-only operating system shared between containers versus the Docker-to-rooted operating system model. So the Docker's pluses are that it updates, don't break an application. So this is what the developers really like, that they don't have to worry about some, you know, security update coming on the host, breaking his application. New version of glibc comes out, or the latest version of Fedora updates comes onto a machine, and all of a sudden your Hadoop server breaks because of that. Really cool. For sandbox, exact opposite. Updates can still break every application in the box. So that's a negative for Vert sandbox. Docker, security updates don't fix the application. This is sort of this is bundling. Okay, you have to think of all the problems that it had in the past with bundling, you have to worry about this. So if I have a problem with my crypto algorithm and I have 1,000 different of these little file systems running, I have to get 1,000 of those applications updated with the fixed new library. They don't get it automatically. Vert Sandbox has the advantage of I update the library, all of a sudden all my applications get the same library. Docker's advantage, simple CLI. Vert Sandbox right now has a complex CLI. Docker has a simple CLI as a negative because they can't do much with it. Right? They can only do sort of really cool things, really demos well, but if you want to do advanced things like set up different types of networking, you have to get inside of the container and set up all the networking. Or if you want to do C groups management, things like that, you can't do it with it. Ours has a comprehensive CLI. So our CLI can do things like setting up SE Linux, setting up different types of networking, setting up different types of C groups. The great thing, as I mentioned before, is upstream repository. Right now, Vert Sandbox, it's no easy way to ship. I'm running out of time. I haven't got the demo. No easy way to ship images. Docker is really hot technology. Vert Sandbox, no one's even heard of. Real problem with Docker is hard to verify what packages you have installed in your box. The Docker images don't even come with things like an RPM or a deb list of packages that are installed on it. Okay, so you can't get versions. You can't go and run one command that gets you the versions of everything that's installed in the machine. Shared user, so RPM-V works. Developers love it. Docker systemd integrations in Vert Sandbox, not currently into Docker, although you can run entire operating system in it, but systemd is tied totally to Vert Sandbox. I'm not sure the security guys are going to love. As a matter of fact, I know security guys are not going to love Docker model. That being said, I think from my point of view, they're both going to happen. So I think our future, Red Hat's future, is to merge both of these two things together so we can get better shared CLI, so you can launch either to rooted operating system containers or shared host operating system containers. OpenShift plans to use both because all its customers are coming to them and saying, hey, I can go to this really nice website and has a really nice packaged application. Can I run that inside of OpenShift? So they need it. We have questions, and, you know, Reddit, this stuff's not going to be supported out of the box in RHEL 7. When 7 comes out, it's going to be evolving, but we want to ship all this stuff inside of RHEL 7 point something. Docker right now will run, will shortly run on 6.5, and it'll run on 7, so you'll have to go to Docker. You won't necessarily be able to get the code directly from Red Hat. But it'll be, you know, we'll slowly merge these two things together. So Vert Sandbox is available, will be available out of the box in RHEL 7. So the question is, we have questions inside of Red Hat, is what does it mean? People are going to want to ship RHEL images. So you're not going to be able to, guaranteed you're not going to have a RHEL image sitting on docker.com that you can take RHEL code and just download it to your box. But we might have some mechanisms where you can do it inside of your company so you could create your own RHEL image and sort of, you know, set up your own repository and have the Docker command just suck in a Hadoop running on RHEL image. As I said, mentioned earlier, from a security point of view, how do I update these bundled images? How do I get security updates onto them? There's also a huge discussion right now going on Fedora Futures talking about this idea of secure applications on the desktop. So the real, what some of the people in Fedora Desktop and actually Ubuntu has the same goal is to basically they want to start shipping, say, things like Firefox, OpenOffice, and stuff like that, and allow the upstreams to package up their own containerized environments and allow you the distributions to suck down, or users to be able to suck down these containerized applications and run them on the desktop and have them feel like they're a regularly installed application on the desktop and totally integrated, but they will be containerized. From a security point of view, I kind of like this idea, but from a security point of view, if it's bundled shared libraries and stuff, I'm not crazy about it. So it's sort of, you know, there's goodness and badness in it. So that gives you an idea of what's going on with the tech tools. If we can run a couple minutes over time, I'll give you a demonstration of what a container looks like. So I have a container running here on the box right now. So this is, I'm on the host right now, and if you okay, so basically you see I have an Apache web server running here. It's running systemd, is port number 10748. It's running Apache, and it's actually running journal inside of the container. Let me shrink that a little bit. It's also wrapped with an SE Linux label to make sure we control breakouts. So if I want to go and execute a command inside of the command, so what I'm going to do now is I'm actually going to join the container. So right now I'm outside of the container. I'm about to enter the container. So the first thing we're going to do inside of the container is we're going to do get enforce. Can you believe that I would actually run a machine with SE Linux disabled inside of it? Okay. Actually, what's happening here is we're lying to the processes inside of the container. So we have set up libSE Linux, the tool that tells you whether you're enforcing it. Actually, it's above SE Linux. When we set up the container, we set it up so that it looks like SE Linux is disabled. The reason we're doing that is not from a security point. We're not trying to fool anybody. But what we want to do is make sure that tools that have SE Linux built into them don't try to do SE Linux stuff. So if we see a tool trying to do SE Linux stuff, we know it's a hack. You know, it's a hacker trying to break out. So we want basically from inside of the container not to do SE Linux stuff. So we tell them, hey, SE Linux is disabled. Don't do any of that SE Linux code that's in there. But if I do a PS, okay, if I do a PS-EZ inside of the container, remember I showed you all those SFIR commands on the outside? Now we see them on the inside, but look at systemd now. What PID is it? It's PID 1, right? We're running journald inside of it. We're running all these Apache versions on it. and for some reason NSSP cache runs inside of it. So if I go now and I do a ifconfig, you'll see that I have an IP address of 192.168.1.100. I'm running on ETH 0 and I have a local host. Now if we go to a terminal outside of the container, I run ifconfig ETH 0. I don't even have an ETH 0 on the machine. Okay, so from this machine's point of view, if this guy's running as EM1, which also doesn't have an IP address, so I'm running on the wireless. So basically, that proves that I have sort of a different IP stack inside of the container. Lastly, if I go host name out here, I use the world champion Boston Red Sox for the name of the sorry Yankee fans in here, but. Okay, but inside host name is Dan1. So you see that the isolation going on and stuff. So now how long does it take me to create one of these containers? I need someone in the room, in the audience, to shout out a name of a container.
Prophets.
Something I can spell.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't spell that. But you're inside a container.
I just exited the container.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so you what I heard Yankees suck? Okay. Okay, so that just actually went out and created the container. If you look at, this is when I talk about the complex CLI versus the simple CLI, Vert Sandbox Service Create, you're stating what the security realm of the container is. So it's a static SE Linux label with a label of SVert LXCT. It's set up networking, I'm saying it's going to have I got to do this again because I use the same IP address as the other one. But so I pick out, I need to pick a different IP address, but I could pick a different IP address. And we have tooling in there that says to clone the Apache unit file. So it's going to go out and create, it's actually going to create the content that's on the host and copy it into the unit file for the container. But in this case, the container.
Unit file system E stuff?
Yes.
Can the two containers both successfully use the same IP address?
No. Just like any two, I guess I could use the same IP address, but it's gonna get blown. I haven't started the container. It's like two machines coming up with the same IP address. It's gonna screw up your networking. That's why. Yes, they get that. Libvirt takes care of. Doing. So now I'm going to do a system control. So I destroyed the other one that was running on the system. What did I call it? Yankee suck.
So you can't spell it.
Okay, no, it went off the screen. But basically now, ta-da! Okay, so that's how easy it is to set up a cloned Apache server inside a container running Apache. Sometimes if I had more time, I could set up hundreds of these things running. So from a security point of view, if I went out and tried to create content on, it's going to tell me it's a read-only file system. So what we do inside of the container when we change our namespace, we actually remount slash as being a read-only file system. So now you can't create it. Not only that, but SE Linux, if you got through the namespace controls here, SE Linux would step in and also say, hey, you're a container running as SVert LXCT, net T, and you're not allowed to create content in slash. But if I go into slash var, I can create content here. And that content is actually existing in a separate directory on this. So if I go back up to the host, var log, so there's the file Dan right here that just got created. If I go back into the container, you'll see the Walls file got created. So it's kind of neat that you, from a management point of view, could actually manage outside the container, manage your content outside of the container, say on 1,000 containers, have a script that just goes and says, hey, I have a new indexed HTML launch pad that I want a new color theme. You just go out and instantaneously update it. This is the power of a of this model versus the other model. As I said, I believe both models are good. So both are interesting, but it depends on your point of view. I've talked to two banks, two major, major, major banks that have totally different worldviews of this. And you would think that they're in the same business. One of them is absolutely gung-ho over the Docker model. They think it's the greatest thing on the planet. The other one says they wouldn't touch the Docker model with a 10-foot pole because of compliance regulations. The other one says they love the Docker model because they're sick of applications breaking when they update the host system. They want a minimal host operating system, and they want to rely on applications. So it's up to the applications to get, to manage their own workflow and get managed.
This.
Well, yeah, no. I mean, well, change root's the same problem, right? It's still, you're managing. The idea is if I have 1,000 versions of NSS Lib that has vulnerabilities.
That,
yeah. So, anyways, that's what containers are, and I believe containers have gotten this really hot image right now. I think in the next generation of computers, we're all going to be using containers in one way or another. So this gives you a view of what's coming down the pike. So. I think we're way out of time.